This episode is brought to you by the 5-Day Money Challenge. Get your stuff together with money and increase your confidence in just 5 days. Save your seat at whitneyhanson.com/moneychallenge and join in on the fun. Hello and welcome to the Money Nerds Podcast, where owning a calculator, budgeting your money, and having a net worth is actually cool. I'm your host, Whitney Hanson, and each week I'll be chatting with inspiring people to learn their secrets to financial success. Now let's dive into the show. Hey guys, welcome back to the show. Today is going to be a ton of fun. We're going to talk about something that we all need to be very aware of and we don't typically like to think about. This is all about protecting yourself as a consumer, your identity, so that people can't steal any of your information. So that's what we're going to chat about today. And I've brought on a very special person to chat about this, actually an expert in this area. So you guys are going to have a ton of fun getting to hear a little bit of behind the scenes of that kind of stuff. But before we dive into a formal introduction and a little bit of an overview of the episode, I wanted to share a couple money wins with you guys. So the first money win comes from Jody. Jody says, I haven't picked up my paycheck for 2 weeks, so I haven't spent it. Hashtag money win. I think that's hilarious. I mean, that's one way to save some money is just don't pick up your paycheck and, you know, you will immediately start saving more. So congrats, Jody. That's awesome. The next money win comes from Kristen. Kristen says, paid off my first big credit card in my snowball today. Hashtag money win. Congratulations. I love that you're using the debt snowball as well. That is what I think the best way to pay off debt quickly. So congrats to you both. You guys are kicking butt and I'm proud of you for saving money. Okay, let's go ahead and dive into today's episode. Today's guest is with Michael Bremer. Michael is the Vice President of Experian Data Breach Resolution Group, and he's also the VP of Consumer Protection at Experian Consumer Services. So basically, he's got a really sweet job where he is helping people protect their identity. So this is through credit reports, credit scores, credit monitoring, and any other type of credit-related information. That's the kind of stuff he's helping people like you and I do. It's really impressive. He also helps businesses with this stuff too. He's got more than 25 years in the industry, so he really does bring a huge diverse wealth of knowledge related to business operations, and he does do a lot with development in identity theft and fraud resolution space for businesses as well. So it's really interesting. This is such an incredible episode to me, especially because I think identity theft is something we all need to be very aware of, and it's kind of scary to think about. So in this episode, we talk about hackers and how do they actually get your information. We talk about steps that you need to take to protect your information, what information you should and should not share. This one was intriguing because a lot of this stuff is everyday things that we don't even realize is a big deal. We talk about W-2 scams and how that is such a very critical thing during tax season, so be aware of that. We talk about how much things cost on the black market. I'm a little nerdy. I'm very into that kind of stuff. So he shares a lot about how much does a passport go for and any type of information. He shares how much that stuff goes for on the black market. So it's kind of interesting. And then lastly, he goes through a list of daily hygiene habits to start implementing in order to protect your identity and your credit. And one of the cool things that I appreciate about Experian is I've done a little bit of work with them in the past, and they are so focused on helping you as a consumer to get all the education, knowledge, and protecting yourself. So I really appreciate their mission there. They have a ton of resources on their website. So make sure you go to Experian.com. And if you do Experian.com/data-breach, get a lot more information about data breaches specifically. So it's really cool stuff. All of this and so much more in this episode. Guys, I am so excited to introduce you to Michael Bremer from Experian.com. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Money Nerds Podcast. Today I'm joined by a very special guest. I have Michael Bremer in the house. So Michael's going to share with us about identity theft and all of this stuff that we don't like to think about, but we really should be thinking about. So Michael, thank you very, very much for taking some time out of your day to be here.
Thank you so much, Whitney. I appreciate it. It'd be fun to chat.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to this because it's one of those things that we need to be aware of, but so many times we're not aware of it until it's too late. And so I'm hoping this can be that preventative measure for a lot of people. But before we dive into that, can you just tell us all who you are, what you do, give us all of those details?
So my title is Vice President of Consumer Protection at Experian, and it's a pretty wide-ranging remit that I have. I've been with Experian for 5 years, and we have been responsible for data breach resolution, which means if an organization has a compromise, regardless of whether it's a lost laptop, it's a non-production server put in production, it's a hack, or as in most cases, it's just employees not doing the right thing or what I call stupid stuff, we come in and we help consumers resolve those identity issues by providing identity theft protection. But more importantly, for the client or the company that had the issue, we'll provide the resources for them to legally notify all those affected parties, set up a call center to answer questions, and then again, provide identity theft protection and fraud resolution so that any affected consumers can have their identity restored to pre-event status. So that's essentially my role.
That's interesting. So I remember back in maybe 2006, 2007, I was first starting off college and I applied for a job at Old Navy. And Old Navy had one of their employees' computers was taken or something happened with that. So I remember receiving a letter in the mail saying, hey, you might want to watch your credit report and make sure everything's okay on there and monitor your credit for a little while. And I was like, what? This is a thing? I didn't even know this happened. So how often does that actually happen where employers and companies need to reach out to people that have either applied for a job or anybody that could be affected by the breach? Does that happen as often as we think?
Well, I'll give you a couple statistics that will quantify this. In 2016, the average consumer, and again, there are 330 million people in the United States, but the average person in the U.S. received 3 notices of some sort of data breach. It may be from their bank, their credit card company, someone they traded with, their ISP, that where they have their email account or internet connection, could be all of the above. At the same time, the Identity Theft Resource Center, which is an industry source, said that about 17 million people suffered identity theft in 2016. Now, identity theft, there's a wide range of things, everything from simple credit card fraud all the way up to the horrific examples of people that lost their medical information and they had somebody go and charge services on there, or they were bilked out of money through opening a new mortgage account or getting a government ID issued and someone using that identity to commit a crime. There can be all sorts of things that can happen. So the general advice is if you see anything going on that's suspicious, you want to address it right away. It's very important. Time is not on your side. So the faster that you can react and protect yourself, and we can get into that in more detail, the better off you are.
So in today's world, you've been in the industry 25 years. So are we more susceptible today than we were when you first started off in this career?
Yes. It's simply there are so many more attack vectors, meaning that 20 years ago, you might have lost some paper or you might have lost your first laptop computer or PC with information on it. Now your identity is all over the internet. You have the cloud. You have interconnectivity just with the number of devices you have within your household, let alone public Wi-Fi versus private Wi-Fi. You have Bluetooth connections. You have all sorts of opportunities where your data is sitting. And once it's out there, once you finish clicking on the keyboard and inputting your information, whether it's to apply for a driver's license or a credit card, or it's at the Social Security Administration, or it's out on your Facebook profile, you have lots of information that's out there, and it's all susceptible depending on what the hackers are looking for. Because hackers nowadays don't just look for one piece of information in one spot. Just like many companies are using big data to be able to help you and solve big issues like curing cancer or stopping the Zika virus, hackers are going and committing fraud or buying data off the dark web to assemble information so that they can use it against you. So I don't mean to sound like Dr. Doom, but it can be very bad. And keep in mind that the hackers are just as smart as anybody that's doing good things to help protect your identity.
It is a little terrifying. So I'm not going to lie. It's like, wow, that is crazy on how much information we put out there without even meaning to. I mean, it's just basic stuff. I'm posting on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever it might be. It's a little scary how much information we're putting out there that the world can see.
That's right. Well, the one thing that is, you got to remember is that if you keep a very high profile in social media, more information is out there. And even the most innocuous details that you think, oh, my address is already out there. Well, wait a minute. If you've left your social security information, and I'll use, you know, an example, I have four kids. And I don't know how many times when I was signing the kids up for their traveling baseball team, you had to supply their address, birth certificate, social security number, to be able to prove that they were that of that age so they can play in the right league and the right tournament and all that. Well, who knows, once that I left that with the coach to turn it into the commissioner, who copied that or where it was. And there's numerous examples, but I use that one because it hits home, because you think, wait a minute, that was like, you know, in my case, my kids are older, you know, that was 12 years ago. My information was already out there. So once it's out there, it's out there. You can't just rewind it.
So what do you do about that then? If you have to supply this information, it might make you feel uncomfortable, but I mean, sometimes you got to do that. How do you protect yourself in that way? If it's like you're trying to sign your kid up for Little League or whatever it might be.
Well, in many cases nowadays, and particularly with the awareness of all the hacks and identity theft that has occurred, you just have to be aware that you don't have to provide that information. A good example is when you go into your doctor's office and you're signing up for a new dentist or a doctor or whatever, you don't have to provide your social security number. The social security number, it was used in the past in a way, if you don't pay your debts, don't pay your bill, that you can go ahead and track that person down. But as long as you provide credit card information, your address on your credit card, that's all you have to do. That's just one simple example. Now, most states, in the past, they used to require you to apply for a driver's license, you had to have your social security number. And in worst case, some states actually had your social security number as your driver's license number.
Oh, man.
And that's all changed. And now in most states, and I'm not aware of any that require you or mandate that you have to provide your social security number. And I'm picking on social security number because that's probably the highest priority of personal identity information, or PII, that we need to protect.
It's kind of terrifying that they used to use social security numbers as your driver's license number.
Well,
oh my gosh.
And on your medical insurance ID card. So you pass that sometimes to the receptionist and she says, oh, I need to make a copy of this. Well, they make a copy of it. Not only do they have a copy for themselves, but remember, it's also stored on the hard drive of the copy machine. So someone, after the office closes, that poses as a cleaner can go ahead, plug into the hard drive on the copy machine and download everybody's social security number for the, you know, the past day or week that they've copied.
Oh, that is so terrifying. And it's probably something they can still do today. Are people, do companies and our businesses more aware of that and more careful with that now?
There's a much greater awareness, and I don't have any numbers that show that, but I can tell you that the larger companies have put into place very strict protocols about how they're handling personal identity information for their consumers if they have it. We still see, though, that smaller businesses, particularly smaller practices where the information that they hold, and I'm going to hit on healthcare, they're not paying as good attention to cybersecurity, or they don't have the resources to invest in cybersecurity, let alone doing the employee training that for folks that are handling personal identity information, they need to take extra care. So that's still a problem. And we see this in particular during this particular time of the year with tax filing going on, that there are huge spike in W-2 scams. And a W-2 scam is simply someone being able to go ahead and get an email address for an important person that is asking for the CFO or the human resource manager, hey, I need you because I'm posing as the CFO. I've gotten a hold of their email account. I need you to send me all the W-2s for 2016 for the employees because we're having an outside audit. So you as a dutiful employee will say, oh, hey, the CFO has asked me to send these W-2 forms, right? Here's the spreadsheet, send it over. And all of a sudden they haven't verified, ooh, wait a minute, that doesn't really look like the exact address for the CFO, or the CFO didn't call me. Am I really sending this to the right people? And before you know it, they've sent everybody's W-2 forms off. So you think, okay, that can happen. But the worst thing about W-2s is not necessarily the first usage, meaning someone could take your W-2 information and file for a refund and get money from the federal government on your behalf. That's a problem because you then can't file a return. Somebody's already filed. You have to unwind that, which is a pain in the neck of the IRS. But all the information that's on your W-2, name, address, social, your employment history, your salary information, that can be used a second time around to apply for a mortgage, a line of credit, to get a government ID. So unfortunately, a W-2 breach is not only bad for the first time around, but can be used to commit multiple incidents of identity theft.
That is the craziest thing I've ever heard. And I can only imagine, especially right now, I mean, as the time we're recording this, we're in March, which is a lot of people are still filing taxes, myself included. And so it's crazy to think that you have to be more careful about your W-2s, but it's not even on a personal side, it's on an employee side too. If you're working with those that type of information, sensitive documents, you've got to really be careful about who you send things to. And that's just craziness to me. It's amazing what people will do.
And it's something that, again, that it happens if the hackers find an attack vector, the way they're doing these scams on W-2s, because every company has W-2s that has employees, they'll go down the street, if you will, and do the same type of hack or attempted scam on the next small business because it's repeatable and predictable, it's easily monetized, and because they're happening in such a rapid pace, law enforcement can't keep up with this.
Wow, that is awful. Okay, so it sounds like tax season for sure. Be aware of identity theft. Are there any other seasonal things that we should be aware of where we should just pay a little extra attention?
Some of the times of the year we see more activity specifically related to consumer identity theft are around peak shopping seasons where there's going to be more credit card usage. So hackers are going to look for times when if they're going to go ahead and, let's say, put a skimmer on a credit card machine, or they're going to tap into a large retailer and try to steal credit card data, they're looking for peak traffic times. So that's another one. Or they're looking at particular types of individuals, what they're doing, and let's say brokerage firms during end of the year, because you have high net worth individuals that are trying to take care of tax things and setting up new accounts and that, they'll pick those times. But quite frankly, hacking still is a crime of opportunity. So whether there's a lot of smaller businesses that they can do many break-ins and net the same gain, or they can go after a larger business, which may not be as repeatable and predictable, but hacking into a top five bank is still very lucrative if you can take the time to get in there. So it really depends. And hackers have set up there's certain hackers and certain attack vectors that people specialize in. It's not everybody sells high end cars. Some people sell Volkswagen. Some people sell Aston Martins. Hackers do the same thing. They'll focus in on certain areas where they can focus their expertise and then make it successful.
That's craziness. It kind of almost sounds like you're not really safe no matter what you think you're doing. Is that the case? I mean, are you really damned if you do no matter what?
Well, I would like to think of it more as everybody should take some basic precautions. And there's about 5 or 10 things which I can list off very quickly that everybody should do as just general identity hygiene.
Yeah.
One, don't carry around any important documents like your Social Security card in your wallet if you can help it. Yeah, you have to have your medical ID card, but make sure if your insurer has your social as your medical insurance ID, ask them to change that and you can have that done. Okay. Shred any documents that you don't need immediately. Generally, if we pay bills in a month, keep maybe 2 months of your old bills for proof that you've paid them, but everything besides that, unless it's specific for taxes, should be shredded. Don't use public Wi-Fi. It is, yes, free. It is easy. It saves you money. But public Wi-Fi is very susceptible to being hacked and any transaction. And particularly if you're using it for online banking or credit card transactions, anything like that, it's very easy for the hackers to take any of that data transmitted over public Wi-Fi, either tapping into the an actual address or setting up a fake pseudo name for a public Wi-Fi site and taking that data. So never use public Wi-Fi. Spend the extra money using your cellular charges and just don't tap into it. You know, a couple other things would be if you see anything on a statement, a bank statement, a credit card statement, an insurance explanation of benefit that looks suspicious, follow up to see what happened, because people that are suspicious of transactions and follow up and check those statements generally can catch some sort of anomaly that might start out as innocent. Hey, somebody's just testing to see if they can use your medical ID to get services. You can stop further things happening. As I said earlier in one of my comments, time is not on your side. If you let stuff go, it can result in much bigger identity theft. So those are a few things, not a comprehensive list, but some of the basic things. One other thing I should mention that actually rises to the top. Don't click on any links and emails, even from people you know, because your email can be compromised and someone can take over your contacts. Wow. Someone gets a hold of that and says, hey, okay, you and I are just going through this podcast right now, but I now know your email address. And I all of a sudden send you something and say, hey, Whitney, would you please donate to my cause for my dogs, and here's my Venmo account, click on this link. And you're thinking, oh, hey, I just talked to Mike. Yeah. It's great. I'll give him $5. Well, it wasn't me. Someone compromised my email address and you clicked on it innocently thinking, oh, hey, he's a nice guy. And if you do that 1,000 times in a day with somebody, you know, if you have a large friends list, you know, at $5 a pop, that's a nice little living that you can do as a hacker. It may sound simple, but that's how the hackers work. If they can make it repeatable and predictable, they'll do that. And they're preying on the fact that you're trusting someone else's email account. And that's something you shouldn't do. So don't click on any links.
Good to know. What a bummer, too. It's like they're getting you from your friends and your family list. And you're thinking it's innocent, but you could be being scammed. That sucks.
Well, it even happens at work. I'll give you a statistic because I know this one is pretty hard and fast. Phishing scams where someone says it's the in the old world, it was the Nigerian prince asked you to send $2,500 to help save his son. Okay, that's the obvious worst example of a scam. But a phishing scam can be very well disguised, and all it takes is you not paying attention. It looks real. It comes from your boss. It's from your church or your charity of choice. And people create these to make it look very real. And you're trying to be nice and going through it quickly. So if it looks suspicious or it has any links, delete it, put it in your junk email, and don't mess with it, because one, it's going to lead to bigger things. But two, everybody has a problem with this. Example, and the statistic I'll share with you is that most companies of large size are taking their employees through training on how to spot phishing emails. Yeah. But even recent studies say that employees that had training in the morning and then went back to their desks in the afternoon, more than a third of the emails that went through training on the morning still fell prey to a phishing scam in the afternoon within 5 hours of having the training.
Wow.
And so it's still employee negligence or personal negligence that caused you to do this. So you just have to be aware.
So, okay, let's talk about the phishing thing specifically. How do you detect a phishing type email? What if somebody sends links on a normal basis? Like, hey, check out this article. I thought it was pretty cool. How do you know if it's phishing?
Some of the things to spot is if you look up in the URL, which is the convention at the top of the screen, which says, you know, it's from Mike Bremer at Experian or whatever the case, check to make sure. You can spot sometimes that they would say Experian's not spelled correctly. It's a valid email address, but it's not actually my email address. Also look for any misspellings, misbranding, miscoloration. If it, you know, it's a color email with a logo on it, look for that. Again, never click on any links. But one of my rules of thumb is, even if someone sends me a link or a picture or someone that thinks I should be interested in it and I'm familiar with them, I won't even think about opening it unless they either called me in advance to say, hey, Mike, I'm sending you this picture of my son over at South by Southwest in Austin playing in his band. Take a look at it. Well, if they call me in 10 minutes beforehand, generally I know their email is not going to be compromised and it's legit. Or if I'm suspicious, and I know this is a pain, if it's something important, people are going to call me or I'm going to call them to validate that it's a true email if it's something important. And it's okay to ignore stuff.
Yeah.
It's better to ignore a request and have the person get a hold of you than just assuming that that email isn't compromised.
That is so wild. My mind is blown from all the crazy stuff that can happen. Personal example that you'll probably appreciate. Recently, I bought a new domain through GoDaddy. So I went on there, bought my domain, no big deal. About a week later, I received a phone call. It was a California number, I believe. So it looked pretty legitimate. And the person that had called me was like, I'm from GoDaddy and we're giving you five free emails or something like this. I'm like, oh, that's cool, but I don't really need them. They're like, no, it's great. We just need to verify your card that you purchased the domain with. I'm like, okay, go ahead. And I'm like, I'm happy to verify the last four. Go ahead and tell me, you know, what do you have on file? No, we need you to do the whole card number. And so I sat there and I literally had an argument with this hacker. I'm like, dude, I'm not going to give you my card number. But I think a lot of people would have. That was the part that I'm like, oh, no, I wonder how many people are falling victim to this.
And that's an easy one. And it's very typical because you're thinking, hey, it's innocent. It's those innocent ones that will get you, and we all get busy. All of us get 100 to 200 emails in our inbox, and so we're trying to be dutiful and get through them, and that's exactly what the hackers are preying on. And they make it easy, particularly on the internet now with the underground network. You can buy kits. So I'm not a very technical person, but I can go out on the dark web now and I can buy a ransomware kit or a denial of service attack kit to be able to execute. And there's step-by-step instructions. If I have no technical expertise, I can follow those instructions and conduct those attacks or set up a phishing scam in step-by-step do-it-yourself instructions from a hacker for, you know, anywhere from $400 to $1,000. And so you look at the economics of doing that against a bunch of people, the payback's ridiculous and it's easy to do. And they'll also help you disguise your IP address so people can't track back that it's happening for Mike Bremer in Austin, Texas.
That is so wild. So I understand the point of like not giving out your social or not giving out your card number, that kind of stuff. But I mean, this is like a total, I'm just curious question. What does like a typical credit card? I mean, how much are people actually selling these for? Is it actually worth it? It seems like they get caught really quickly.
It depends. And I'll speak, and I don't mean to make this as an advertisement for one or more credit card companies, but all credit card companies have some sort of fraud detection built into their normal operations. Mm-hmm. So I'll use credit card company A, and as part of my online account, anytime I make a transaction and I can set a dollar amount, I'm going to get a notice as to what's going on. So that kind of credit card company will alert me if I'm making any purchases, whether it's even an additional card holder on my account. So I can actually see, and I've got a couple kids in college, you know, if they're using the quote unquote emergency card for regular purchases at the bar.
Yep.
Which, you know, obviously rings a bell in dad's head and
for multiple reasons.
Exactly. But the fact of the matter is there are certain card companies that don't have all of those same fraud protections. So if a card is compromised and you don't have an online alert set up and you're just waiting on your monthly statement, you know, you have 25 or 30 days to go have charges run up before all of a sudden you look and say, wait a minute, I didn't spend $5,000 on my, you know, XYZ card in that month. So it's important with some of the free protections that many card companies have to sign up for those things and pay attention to them. Now, the good news, having said what I just said, is that most credit card companies have zero liability, meaning if false charges are made and you report to that card company within the first 30 days, and sometimes they'll allow 60 days, all of those charges can be waived off. However, debit cards, on the other hand, don't always have all the same protections. Some of them do, but in the case of a debit card that may be tied to your mortgage account, your brokerage account, your ATM, they could, theoretically, if they get your debit card information and have your PIN that they have been able to get through setting up a camera the last time you went to your local ATM, they could drain your bank account, let alone your savings or your mortgage account, depending on how much access is available. Wow. So it's good to pay attention even with credit cards. And credit cards, you asked the question, I didn't answer it directly. Credit cards are selling for $1 to $5, stolen ones on the internet now, compared to, let's say, a medical identity that's stolen that you have name, address, social, medical insurance ID, and potentially some other information. That may be $10 to $50, depending on where you are in the country. And W-2s, stolen W-2s, as of last week, are out in the internet for $10 to $25.
Oh my gosh.
A W-2.
What about a passport?
Passport, not quite as expensive. I think the number's probably, you know, in the $10 to $15 range. And it usually is part of a fuller identity string. So many times you're looking at, I mentioned in an earlier answer how the hackers are taking advantage of big data. So they may get your passport number in one hack from the place, you know, the local place that does expedited passports. So this isn't the Department of the Interior that gets your passport in the States, but it's one of those expediters. So they have a database, and if that's stolen, but then they also get your driver's license number, your social security number, and your credit card, they'll pull it all together to get it as a single identity string to be used for bigger things. And that full identity string with more information on it could go for $50 to $100, especially if it's a high net worth individual and they know that has high balances. So, you know, on one of my credit card, I have, over five figures of a credit limit. Well, that one I want to make sure it's very well protected versus, you know, a throwaway card that I have only for $1,000 that I use for some Amazon purchases on a regular basis.
This is so fun. So let's chat about I mean, I know now we know it's a big deal. So first question is, how do we protect ourselves? Like, what are some of the easy steps that we can do? Like what kinds of things can we actually say no to? Do we have to give out information when people ask, or does it depend? I mean, I'm really pretty clueless on that part specifically.
It's a bit like your parents the first time they take you through the exercise of saying no to strangers and no to candy.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. You really should have no, and not being impolite, saying no to when someone asked you for information that you don't feel is necessary to complete the transaction. Mm. So I'll use an example. I was staying at one of my regular hotels as part of a national chain. I have a frequent traveler account in there, and I needed to go ahead and get a check cashed for some reason. I can't remember what the circumstance was, but it was a check for $50. And they said, well, they needed to see my driver's license. I said, not a problem. Could we also have your Social Security number? Mm. Well, there's no reason they need my Social Security number for that, because they already have my identity with, you know, my frequent flyer account. They have my credit card information. They know my history. They didn't need my social, but that was the policy that was written in at the front desk. Just say no to that type of thing. Or when somebody asks you even to borrow your insurance information, and keep in mind that about 50% of all insurance fraud is familial.
Oh, wow.
So people are using it to, their cousin, you know, doesn't have insurance cover, so they'll share their insurance card so he can go in and get a visit to the emergency room paid for. That's all, well, not only is it insurance fraud, but in its simplest form, it is identity theft.
Man, so if you were to do that, say you're like, here, cousin, here's my card, go get checked out at the ER, whatever it might be. As if that's my card and I'm lending it to my cousin, what is the repercussions that I would receive legally?
Legally, again, you're committing fraud because you're aiding and abetting. They would actually be committing the fraud, but then your insurance company could come back to you and say, you violated the terms of the agreement. We're going to cut off your insurance cover altogether, let alone if it's your employer's insurance, you potentially put your job at risk.
Wow. Okay. So another scenario I came across, and this is relevant. Tomorrow I leave for Greece, but in December I went to Italy, and this was my first time staying abroad. And I remember the hotel asked to make a copy of my passport. And I said, sure, you know, I guess that they're like, yeah, we really need a copy of that for foreign travel. Is that true? Do I actually have to let them copy my passport if I'm traveling abroad?
No. What they want to be able to do is they want it really to, they're not trying to track you for immigration purposes. They're trying to track you for payment of the bill. And in many cases, and I had this happen before I really paid attention, gotten into the industry, traveling in Eastern Europe in particular, they'll ask if you check into a hotel to keep your passport overnight. And that's so you just won't skip out. Because some people think, okay, hey, I don't have to pay the bill in a foreign country. Well, if they've got your passport, it's very hard to walk out of the hotel because you're kind of out of luck if you don't have your passport when you're traveling. But nowadays, again, I've been out of the country recently. They don't ask for your passport anymore because they know the potential repercussions. Asking for it, if it is not held in a safe, they shouldn't be holding it anyway because they've got your credit card information. But it's a risk of identity theft. So don't let any important documents out of your hand. And in most cases, you're not required to. Now, it'd be different if you were in Italy and the police came up to you and asked you to surrender your passport.
Yeah.
I wouldn't, unless they had the ability to take you downtown and say they were going to charge you with something. But it's a little bit different if the government is asking for it versus a private organization like a hotel.
That's fair. Okay, that's good to know. So if I come across that again, I will politely say no to that. So, okay, I think we've chatted about a lot of really dang good information. So let's start wrapping it up. If you had to just share a couple steps, like what should we be doing on a yearly basis to check in to make sure our identity is not being stolen? If it is, what are the next steps? So let's just go through maybe that process, if that's okay with you.
Sure. And Whitney, I'd like to start at the, you know, kind of the daily hygiene and work all the way up to the annual. So on a daily basis, be suspicious of anything that looks out of place on the bills, on financial statements, on if you have mail that's comes to your house that is addressed to, you know, the deceased mother, the brother that doesn't live with you, things like that. That's something that's out of place that causes you, like, why am I getting that? Mm-hmm. It's good to follow up because you never know if somebody has tried to either divert mail, tried to use, you know, a deceased person in your family as identity, something like that. So be suspicious. Okay. We talked about online shopping a little bit in credit cards. If you're going to have a credit card that you use for major transactions and then a secondary card that you use for online shopping only that has a very low credit limit. So even if it gets compromised, it's, you know, the you're not going to run up a bunch of charges. And even though you're not liable for the charges, it'll just save you some time. Always keep any documents like passports, birth certificates, visas, titles to cars, anything like that, important documents, keep them locked up in a fireproof safe at home. Always shred documents, anything that you don't immediately need. And there's tons of places that can give you, you know, even if you buy something, you get a free shredder. There's great opportunities to do that. Never click on any links for email. Never open any attachments unless you've spoken to that person before and know that it's legitimate. And then watch out for any funny emails, emails that you may suspect from somebody that you haven't spoken to for a while or somebody asking for any type of information. I always say just delete them. Don't even put them any place where they could be potentially opened up, because we do have an example of where a family is sharing a computer. Mm-hmm. And dad gets an email, he puts it in the junk folder, and all of a sudden, you know, the kids are playing on it, they go in the junk folder and said, oh, hey, that's to my dad, that looks kind of interesting. They click on it and boom, they download keylogging software onto the computer that begins a whole problem.
Oh, man.
On a monthly basis, again, look at your statements, make sure that in fact that you don't have any request for a change of address from the post office or stuff that gets delivered to you. You know, I've had stuff that was delivered to my address that somebody I found out that was down the street was actually picking up. They didn't have it. They had stolen the person's identity and it was addressed to my neighbor, but it was delivered to my address so that they could go ahead and pick it up.
Oh, crazy.
Figure that out. Watch out for that stuff. And then on an annual basis, I always say during tax time, make sure you go and clean out all of your receipts. I think nowadays you only have to save receipts up to 5 years for tax purposes. But every other piece of paper that you have, if it's not locked in your fireproof safe or it's needed for taxes, it's junk. Get rid of it. Shred it. And most of those things, if you do that on the, you know, the daily, weekly, monthly, and then the annual basis, you'd be in pretty good shape.
So from a crediting perspective, I mean, you guys see, I don't even know how many millions of credit reports. How many? Okay, so if I find something on my credit report and I'm like, ooh, that should not be there. It's an account that I didn't actually open, whatever it might be. I've heard horror stories that they're really, really hard to get off your credit report. Is that pretty true?
We try to make it as easy as possible. The numbers that we have at Experian are about 99.1 or 2% of all credit reports are accurate.
Wow.
Now, you have 260 million people that have a live credit file of are of age in the U.S. So even just less than 1% of 260 million is still a large number. We try to make it very easy. There are what we call an online dispute process where you can actually go into Experian and say, hey, I'm disputing this entry in my credit report. And then we have 30 days to with which to go to the creditor or the person that gave us the entry, because we are a credit reporting agency. We don't make these things up. We get them from your bank or your the federal government or the state or from another creditor and put that on your report. But we have an online process to do it, and then we have a dispute team that you can call in and tell them your circumstance and work through it. And their obligation to the consumer is to ensure that they satisfy the consumer's needs. Now, if there's a battle between your bank and yourself about did you actually make the final payment and close out that net loan, we can't get in the middle, but we'll help broker the conversation so that you can resolve that. And then as long as the bank says, yes, you know, Whitney did make that final payment, here's the canceled check, you're going to get it cleaned up off of your report. And that's our first and foremost concern, is making sure that your credit report is fine. And even with data breaches, and most people that suffer a data breach event with us and they sign up for identity theft protection, and we always provide a credit report for the consumer to look at. So we're not just monitoring for future events, but we encourage people to look at their credit report, and at no charge, we'll go back as long as they need to in their credit history to make sure that any inaccuracies are corrected immediately. So that's just part of the service we provide when we respond to a data breach.
That's awesome. So what about, I don't come across this too often with coaching people that I work with, but occasionally you'll see the situation where their parents took their identity, the child's identity, and now they're an adult, they're 20, 25, whatever it might be, and they're looking at that and they're seeing that, hey, that's a card that's not me, and it turns out it was the parents. Does that happen? I mean, do you have any stats on that? Does that happen that frequently anymore?
You have to repeat it because you were breaking up a little bit.
Oh, darn. Okay. So specifically with parents stealing their children's identity, how often does that actually happen? Do you guys come across that very often anymore?
Yeah, in terms of just what I would call single identity theft, so your identity hasn't been breached as part of a larger event, like it wasn't due to the recent Yahoo spate of, you know, email attacks the attack that compromised all the email addresses. But familial identity theft one-on-one, where credit cards are shared or accounts are abused that way, or insurance cards, happens probably in terms of total identity theft about 10 or 15% of the time. So I'll give you a magnitude of the identity theft cases that we see. So last year, the Experian Data Breach Resolution Team serviced about 4,000 different data breaches, which seems like a lot because in industry numbers, they report maybe 1,000 to 1,500 total breaches. And you're thinking, well, how can Experian serve 4,000? Well, like an iceberg where you only see 15% of it above water, there's a bunch below water that you don't see. That's the same thing with reportable breaches. For those data breaches that we serviced last year, we had about 22,000 cases of identity theft that were reported across all of those breaches, involving, you know, anywhere between 30 and 40 million people in total. Mm-hmm. So the instance of true identity theft, regardless of the type, is, you know, 1 to 2% of the total number of people that could potentially have been affected by a breach. But when it happens, like I say, you know, 1 to 10% involve a familial stealing of that. And you just go back to some of my tips. Don't share your information. Don't share your credit card. Don't share your insurance card or your passport with anybody else. Yeah. It's hard to say, oh, hey, you know, you got to lock those up in front of your sister, your brother, your aunt and uncle, but it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good to know. Well, this has been super informative. I've had a blast and it gives me a lot to think about personally too. So I really do appreciate you taking your time to be here, but is there any final tips or any little nuggets that you'd like to share before we wrap up?
No, I think you covered everything. It's been fun talking to you as well, and I hope this is valuable for all your listeners.
Oh, I think it will be. Mike, thank you so much for being here. I've had a ton of fun geeking out with you.
Thanks, Whitney.
Okay, what'd you think? Wasn't that so freaking interesting? One of the things that really stood out to me was this whole concept of you can say no. Like, you don't have to give out information. And sometimes we think we have to, we feel obligated to, and you actually don't. So that was something that I really took away, was being extremely protective over any of my personal information. I also took away that when you have a personal profile, and maybe that's online or maybe it's not, I don't, whatever it is, you're putting out a lot of information that can be used against you. And so frankly, I don't really know how to protect myself from that, because that's part of my business model, is being out in front of people. But it was something to think about, and it was something that I'm definitely taking to heart and thinking through some of the information I put out there. If you have loved this episode as much as I have, I would sure appreciate it if you shared this with a friend. This is how the podcast grows, and it really does mean the world to myself and to the guests that are on here taking the time to share this amazing information. If you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe to the podcast as well, and leave a review if you have not done so either. Those mean the world to me. It's so fun to see your comments and what you're liking. I really do appreciate it. It really makes this podcast worth it. All right, that's it for today. Thanks so much for joining in, and I will see you guys next week for another episode of the Money Nerds Podcast. Bye.